Welcome to Weill Cornell Medicine CancerCast, conversations about new developments in medicine, cancer care, and research. I'm your host, Dr. Manish Shah, and today we will be talking about liquid biopsies and how this technology is used in cancer care. Our guest today is Dr. Massimo Cristofanelli. Dr. Cristofanelli is an internationally recognized medical oncologist, investigator, and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine, New York Presbyterian Hospital. He serves as the Associate Director of Precision Oncology at the Meyer Cancer Center, as well as the Scientific Director of the Englander Institute for Precision Medicine. Dr. Cristofanelli's research focuses on biomarkers of endocrine resistance in breast cancer, liquid biopsies, and novel drug development. Massimo, welcome.
Thank you, Manish. I'm glad to be here.
So today's topic is really dear to our heart because it feels very cutting edge. The ability to take a blood sample and learn a lot about someone's tumor. It would be great to have a discussion with you about what this means and where we can go in the future. There's this idea that we can do a liquid biopsy versus a tumor biopsy or a traditional biopsy. Can you tell us what the difference is between liquid biopsy and a regular biopsy?
Tissue biopsy has been the gold standard, the traditional way to assess, first of all, the histological diagnosis of the disease, based mostly on the location, but also in patients with distant metastasis in different locations from the organ of origin. And then the biomarkers that define more and more the individualized treatment for any individual. So we went from histology, simple biomarker by immunohistochemistry, and biomarker by NGS, so genomic analysis. As you can imagine, over time, we figured out that, in fact, the disease is very heterogeneous and may change over time in terms of biomarker development and under the pressure of treatment, and can also be different, especially metastatic disease, based on the location of the recurrence. Multiple sites may be different from the original tumor over time, as I mentioned, based on the pressure of the treatment. So a liquid biopsy is more of a real-time assessment of where the disease biology is, and technology has improved tremendously. Originally, we had only the ability to really examine circulating tumor cells, and this was also a significant challenge when we achieved that now more than 20 years ago, because circulating tumor cells are extremely rare in the peripheral blood of patients with primary metastatic disease, so had to be enriched with immunomagnetic separation. And the first step was actually to enrich and count the cells, and cell search was the first technology got approved, because when we were able to identify these cells and count these cells, there was a cutoff of 5 cells, both from breast and prostate cancer, that was prognostic, essentially classified the patient with more aggressive disease versus not. Later on, we were able to really establish the ability to individualize treatment based on the biomarkers on CTCs.
So you said that we take some blood from a patient, and using technology, we can identify circulating tumor cells. So these are cells that are in the blood floating around, and they may represent the tumor. But from a liquid biopsy, I think you were mentioning also that we could look for circulating tumor DNA or cell-free DNA. And that's very different too, right?
Yes. In the last 10 years, with the improvement in technology, with the ability to separate DNA from the patient, the germline DNA from the tumor DNA, and detect a very small amount of tumor DNA, we entered a new era, because now the ability to detect small amount of tumor-derived DNA and be able to really classify this tumor based on the specific variant of individual mutations, allele frequency of individual variants, and even fraction of the tumor at different time points, has completely changed the way we address tumor treatment monitoring in the metastatic setting. So we have the ability of identify CTCs, number and biomarkers. We have the ability to detect cell-free DNA. The two modality can be complementary. So we cannot do, for example, estrogen expression or HER2 expression in the DNA, but we can do amplification, we can do mutations of specific genes, including HER2 and ESR mutations in the patient with advanced disease. So clearly, the ability to have a complete characterization of the disease using different liquid biopsy methods.
Tumor markers. So these are proteins like CA125 or CEA or CA19-9 that tumors can express, and they're secreted and they're in the blood and you can measure them. And then the higher the level, the more is being secreted by the tumor, and it sometimes represents the disease burden. Now, the more cutting edge is what we're talking about here, which is either circulating tumor cells, so tumor cells that have extravasated from the tumor into the circulation, or DNA that may represent the tumor as well. And either of those are now options. But people may come across something called cell-free DNA or circulating tumor DNA. And can you describe the difference, if there is any?
Only a fraction of the cell-free DNA is actually tumor DNA. Sometimes there is contamination by other sources. There is necrotic DNA. We're talking primarily about circulating free tumor DNA, the cell-free DNA. In some cases, they cannot differentiate from germline or abnormal erythropoiesis, and in some cases cannot differentiate from DNA that is not tumor-derived. But in general, we have the ability to detect, based on technology developer, be able to filter this DNA that is not derived from the tumor. So you have specific mutations that are primarily derived from the tumor, represented the tumor. In tumors where it's difficult to obtain a tissue biopsy and do a molecular analysis, the reflex test will be the cell-free DNA. This has been established in lung cancer. It will come pretty soon in breast cancer and in other tumor types. Having a report from a cell-free DNA takes, I think, between 5 and 7 days. Having a tissue biopsy with NGS, any molecular analysis, takes at least 2 weeks. And of course, it's an invasive procedure.
So this is really exciting. And what you were saying at the beginning is that tumors are heterogeneous. So in the case of metastases, there might be a metastatic lesion in the liver, there might be one in the bone and the lung, and each of those areas might be somewhat different in terms of some of these biomarkers. And if you are able to do a liquid biopsy, you might be able to get a better sense of the entire tumor, because what you're collecting from the blood is not from one tissue, one biopsy, but it integrates all the tumor cells or DNA that leaves the tumor at all those areas and it winds up in the blood. Is that right?
Correct. I think this is the most exciting aspect of molecular diagnostics. You have shedding from multiple sites. You'll be able to understand exactly how the overall tumor burden and molecular representation of the disease is coming from different sites. We see, for example, in patients with breast cancer, they have soft tissue, liver, lung, and in hormone receptor positive, it's not uncommon also to have bone disease. Of course, we don't have an easy access to bone for repeating a biopsy. With a liquid biopsy, we can actually understand the contribution of this component from the bone, liver, and lung. And it's also important to differentiate. We will get to the point where the different mutations can predispose to different sites of recurrence, and the liquid biopsy can evolve in a way that tell us not only which mutation is present in the peripheral, but where it's coming from. For example, there are some mutations that are more common in liver versus bone, and we will be able to understand the overall contribution from the shedding, the type of mutations.
That's really exciting. So it sounds like this is potentially very useful, and it will provide more information about the status of the patient's cancer that is underneath the detection of a CAT scan or PET scan. Literally, you can identify individual cells or individual DNA fragments. You began saying earlier that in breast cancer, the initial circulating tumor cell assays, there was a threshold. And if you had below 5, then that was negative. But above that certain threshold, then that was positive and indicated tumor cells. Can you explain why there's a threshold that's not 0? How does that work?
There is no clear reason why the cutoff of 5 actually was able to discriminate patients with more aggressive disease and a shorter survival compared to the patient with less than 5. We published a pool analysis just recently, showed that 5 remains a very good prognostic and predictive biomarker, meaning that if the patient is receiving a treatment and there is no change, meaning that the cells do not go below 5, the patient has a much shorter survival. But most important, we also show that there is a continuous from 1 all the way to 5 has a worse outcome compared to 0. So clearly, that 0 would be the ideal. depends on the subtype that you have, but anything between 1 and 5 seems to be associated with a shorter survival. 5 remains the established cutoff that's present also in the FDA clearance and approval back in 2005. So this is true only for prostate and breast. I think it's been extensively shown in prostate that the response is associated with a drop in CTC every time there is this, it's a survival advantage. In colorectal cancer, you may know the cutoff was actually only 3, and it was never utilized significantly in prospective studies. But the advantage has been also that in breast and in prostate, we'll be able to assess estrogen receptor, HER2 expression in breast, androgen receptor expression in prostate, and RB mutations in prostate, as well as ESR mutation most recently in breast. These are mutations associated to the cells, to the DNA within the cells, not cell-free DNA.
So if a patient has a circulating tumor cell count that's less than 5, does that mean that the patient will have recurrence, but it'll be delayed? Or some of these patients don't have recurrence, so somehow these circulating tumor cells get cleared?
So we studied this extensively. There is a tendency to develop metastatic disease in other sites much faster rate. So this patient progressed to visceral metastasis at a faster rate compared to a patient who have less than 5. Because this was just prognostic, it was investigated also as a predictive biomarker, meaning that if a patient has more than 5 CTCA, an estrogen positive tumor, can we randomize patient to a more aggressive treatment, chemotherapy versus endocrine therapy, standard of care for ER-positive disease? This was done from the French investigator in the STIC trial, and it showed that, in fact, the CTC-positive group, the most than 5, the one that have a faster progression, when they are treated with chemotherapy, in spite of being ER-positive, do better, improving the progression-free survival, overall survival, compared to being treated only with endocrine therapy based on the expression of ER in the tissue. This was proving level 1 evidence, and in fact, when you have this particular prognostic biomarker, more than 5, you will need to intensify your treatment, in this case with chemotherapy.
What you're saying is that CTCs that are greater than 5, you have a higher risk of getting visceral metastases, earlier chance of recurrence, and maybe you might benefit from more aggressive therapy. But for patients who are less than 5, so maybe not negative, but less than 5, can patients clear their CTC without treatment, or does every circulating tumor cell that comes up on the assay, is it actually a cancer cell that could lead to metastases?
So these are epithelial cells that are being demonstrated to be cancer cells. These patients have usually a better and longer response to standard treatments. And again, this has been shown in thousands of patients in multiple studies, prospective or retrospective. There is no resistance to treatment. Eventually, the patient will progress, but take a much longer time. That's why the stratification based on CTC, even if they don't receive different treatment, the same treatment doesn't work the same way on patient with more than 5 CTC or less than 5 CTCs.
So the CTC count is both prognostic. People with a higher CTC count have perhaps a more aggressive and a worse survival, and also predictive. CTCs that are higher than 5, they don't benefit the same from the same therapy as lower than 5.
Absolutely correct.
Is the test reliable? If I did a CTC on Monday morning, will I get the same count Wednesday morning?
Yes. So this has been studied multiple times of the days to look at the circadian changes, the shedding of the cells, and there was no difference. So multiple times of the day or consecutive days. This was early days when the technology cell search was being developed, because this obviously was question needed to be addressed, put in the application for the FDA.
It's a reliable test that's predictive and prognostic. So based on what you're saying, it seems like everybody should be doing it, right?
Yeah. This test has been available, as I mentioned, for 20 years. For a period of time, there was an issue with insurance reimbursement. And of course, physicians don't feel that they want to put the patient under the stress of insurance. Right now is covered by Medicare and different payers, and is available through Menarini, that is the provider that has a central lab established. You can have CTC enumeration, you can have CTC with biomarker, including PD-L1, HER2. So it depends on the physician, and if they feel that they want to use it, it's available and it's reimbursed.
So it's available and reimbursed, and it's basically a blood draw. How many tubes? Is it 10 cc's of blood?
2 tubes of blood. The test is run on a 10cc, but for this technology, you need to have two tubes of blood.
That's really terrific. So then that's circulating tumor cells. I had a question about the platform. So you mentioned cell search, right? There's one platform. How is that done and what are the differences of different platforms?
So cell search is immunomagnetic separation, semi-automated, and this being, as I mentioned, the only FDA-approved test for prognostic enumeration of epithelial cells. It's a cocktail of biomarkers, essentially a cocktail of cytokeratin. It's an EpCAM enrichment method, and you can get the test back in 3 days. Now, because of the ability to detect primarily epithelial cells, understanding the metastatic disease may have cells that are no longer epithelial, but mesenchymal. There have been a number of technologies that have been developed without having FDA approval that really use different methods for cells isolation. Some based on physical microfluidic separation, where the cells are essentially filtered by size through a microfluidic device and then collected at the end of the process. And these cells can be stained then for the typical biomarker, nuclear markers, cytokeratin, other biomarkers. Usually you see at least the same number of cells, if you know more, suggesting in fact that some cells are missed with the cell search. And then there are filtration systems where it's a much easier process overall. You have the ability to examine and put under the microscope cells, look at morphology of cells, and you can theoretically look at also immune cells in the peripheral blood. So I think the technology available give it the possibility to expand. These are more for research purposes. If you want to start a more aggressive disease, you want to understand the evolution of the cells. That's possible, and we have a laboratory where we have several of these technologies to evaluate CTC at different stages of the disease.
So cell search is the only one that's FDA approved, and it's based on magnetic beads on specific markers. You mentioned EpCAM, but then there are other technologies. So there was a clinical trial that was presented at ASCO in the plenary session. I believe you were part of that study that really centered on the use of circulating tumor cells as an application. Do you want to talk about that trial? I think that gives us a real-world example of how this could be used.
You're referring to the cell-free DNA-guided intervention.
That's SERENA-6. It was cell-free DNA.
Correct. So essentially, now moving from the circulating tumor cell to cell-free DNA, we know that we have the ability to detect specific mutations that may drive resistance to treatments. And the most common mutations that we have now for which drugs have been approved are founder or truncal mutation in the PHGK gene and an acquired mutation, ESI mutation, that appears under depression or endocrine therapy, particularly in patients who have been exposed to aromatase inhibitors. There was a study called PADA 1 study that showed that if you were to take patients they had on a first-line endocrine therapy for metastatic disease with an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK4/6, in that case was letrozole and Ibrance, and you monitor their cell-free DNA over time, you see that approximately after 6 months, in a fraction of these patients, you have an ESI mutation that appears. In the design of the study, they plan to essentially stage these patients when they had a mutation and find out if they have a recurrence, they will be treated as a second-line treatment. If you have no recurrence, those patients will be randomized to change in the aromatase to fulvestrant and continue the CDK4/6 versus continue the same treatment. It would appear that this strategy actually changed the progression-free survival of these patients. So because of that, we know that Faslodex, fulvestrant, is also not effective in patients with ESR mutation. A group of investigators, and I was involved in the design of this study, decided to design a much larger study where we use a specific drug that is effective in ESR mutant cells, and this was camizestrant. So the SERENA-6 is a two-step study. We had to screen patients that were on AI and CDK for more than 6 months by testing their cell-free DNA every 3 months. And then when we detected the cell-free DNA, by the cell-free DNA, the ESR mutations, this patient would be randomized. And 315 patients from the original 3,300 patients were found to have an ESR mutation and did not have any evidence of progressive disease. So they had what we call a molecular progression. So that was the randomization. This was a placebo-controlled study where the drug camizestrant was assigned 1-to-1 with the continuation of CDK in placebo versus continuation of the aromatase inhibitor, CDK4-6 treatment, and the placebo. There were several stratification factors, but the most important endpoint was the primary endpoint, the progression-free survival by the investigator, but there was pre-planned progression-free survival too. After the patient progressed, there was no crossover allowed and overall survival. This study was presented as a first reading of the progression-free survival, the cutoff for November 28, 2024, when there were 135 events. And first of all, when you look at the characteristic of the patient, as I mentioned, it was starting at 6 months by study design, but the median time for the patient to be randomized was 23 months. And the mutation that were found were the most common that we know in the hotspot mutations. So the progression-free survival in the patient treated with camizestrant and CDK4-6 with a ESR mutation, no evidence of clinical progression at the time, was 16 months versus 9.2 with an hazard ratio of 0.44. So clear, a significant improvement, a mirror in a way of improving what we have already seen in patients treated with the PADA-1 study. Remember, this is the progression-free survival from the moment of the randomization. So essentially, the study showed you can extend the benefit of endocrine therapy combination simply by changing the endocrine backbone with camizestrant in patients where the ESR mutation is the only driver of resistance. Of course, we have more data that we have to analyze in terms of the allele frequency of the mutation, as I mentioned, the cell-free DNA has the ability to really mirror the response by imaging studies. We can see what happened to the mutation over time when you switch the drug, particularly the ESR mutation variant, even at the level of the variant. And the most important finding that was obviously quite surprising, because again, these are patients that have no evidence of clinical recurrence yet, was the time to deterioration in global health status. So this patient maintained their asymptomatic status for much longer, 23 months versus 6.4 months, meaning that there is intervention at the molecular level reduce the significant impact that usually metastatic disease has in terms of symptoms in patients with hormone receptor positive disease. We are analyzing to see if there is a matter of burden of disease, site of recurrence, and so forth.
So the first thing is that you coined a term called molecular progression. I think that's really interesting, and it highlights the importance of these Leukoid biopsies. I know we talked mostly about circulating tumor cells, but the SERENA-6 study, as you pointed out, shifted to the circulating tumor DNA and the mutation identified there. So molecular progression, for way of definition, it means that there's the occurrence of a mutation that is not seen radiographically that would indicate that there's some activity of the cancer that demonstrates resistance that occurs before the development of new metastatic lesions or progression of the metastatic lesions.
That's correct, yes.
So in the context of having molecular progression, we have a change, in this case, circulating tumor DNA, to have this mutation. I think this is really fascinating. By making a change in the hormonal treatment to overcome that mutation, you can extend the time to radiographic recurrence. You said 16 months versus, was it 9 months?
9 months, yes.
So less than a year, but more importantly, the patient's subjective symptoms of the disease were delayed by almost 2 years, right?
Yes. I think it's important also, now that you're talking about the molecular recurrence, is not only the fact that you have a new mutation that was not there, we treat the mutation, you delay the symptoms, and you prolong the radiological recurrence. But this is something that is never done before. So in a way, change the thinking of treating metastatic, in this case, hormone receptor positive breast cancer. Most of the guidelines really recommend treatment change, even the combinations. You go from a CDK4-6 combination, for example, to a PHK combination as a second line, based on radiological progression, depression, and mutation. This is the first time not only that we treat the molecular progression, but we also change only one drug. We're not changing the combination itself, because the mutation that we see is not due to resistance to a CDK4-6, but it's due to the resistance to the aromatase inhibitors. So this is another fascinating aspect of this study.
That's a really, really good point. What's the current use of this liquid biopsy? In terms of the circulating tumor cells that we were talking about at the beginning, you said that they're FDA approved for prostate cancer and breast cancer, and there's a threshold of 5. It's FDA approved for colon cancer, but we don't use it that often. And the higher the number, it's prognostic, meaning the patients will have more aggressive disease and the tumor might return earlier. In terms of the other aspect of liquid biopsy, which is the circulating tumor DNA, it's a very similar data. So if the assay is able to detect circulating tumor DNA, meaning DNA mutations in the blood that can only come from the tumor, then it is suggestive that the cancer will have recurrence. And at least in GI cancers, and it's probably true in other cancers, let's say after surgery, you're in surveillance and you're hoping that the cancer doesn't come back, the identification of the circulating tumor DNA would increase your risk of having the cancer come back to a very high level. And at this point, unfortunately, we're not really treating based on that value. So it can cause a lot of stress that this circulating tumor DNA is there. I'm looking for recurrence. I don't find it. I have to do scans, and it can be difficult to handle. But you mentioned here, for the first time, we're basically acting in this area where we have some evidence of progression only at the molecular level, and you can change treatment based on that, and you can improve outcomes. Is that fair?
Yeah, I just want to clarify one thing that you mentioned is very important. That is, the post-surgical area is most of MRD detection. So that would be molecular recurrence versus molecular progression. But the point is the same, meaning that if you were to do a test for cell-free DNA in multiple patients over time, prospectively, you see a mutation, nobody treats that mutation in metastatic setting before the recurrence. So this would be the setting we're talking about. In the patients that have surgery, even in breast cancer, now we have evidence that detection of minimal residual disease to cell-free DNA predicts for recurrence, but we don't treat that. We just have imaging, and if there is no imaging, we don't know what to do, because there is a period of time where the disease is not detectable for which there is no established intervention. You can certainly anticipate your metastatic first-line treatment, but this is not being proved, so there is no study for that. So imagine now a study based on this concept in the early disease for MRD detection, for which we can actually intervene even earlier. So we can certainly prolong the survival of patients with high-risk disease in the post-surgical treatment. They have a molecular recurrence before the radiological recurrence. But this one is the first step. That's why I'm glad that you connect with that concept, because it's treating the molecular disease evidence only without waiting for the recurrence, and prove the concept that, in fact, in that case, you can prolong the patient outcome.
I'm glad that you clarified that distinction. In colon cancer, there is a study called the Dynamic Study, where they did a randomized trial. And for stage 2 colon cancer, there are maybe 25% of patients who have some high-risk features. So maybe lymphovascular invasion, maybe a large tumor, or other features. And patients do receive adjuvant chemotherapy in that context. The trial is randomized to usual care. So for stage 2, maybe 25% of patients would have gotten chemotherapy versus a ctDNA guided approach, where if you were ctDNA negative, even if you had a high risk feature at pathology, you wouldn't get treatment. But if you were ctDNA positive, even without a high risk feature, you would get treated. And it turns out that you were able to have the same benefit in both arms in terms of the survival, but the patients who are ctDNA guided, they ended up having actually less chemotherapy. So instead of 25% of patients getting chemotherapy, because it was our best estimate based on high-risk pathologic features, we treated only 17% of patients with chemotherapy. We saved patients from getting chemotherapy when they maybe didn't need it. So that's another application where potentially if you're ctDNA negative, or maybe liquid biopsy negative would be another way to put it, then maybe you don't need as aggressive treatment in this adjuvant setting.
Absolutely. I think the example that you brought up that we haven't really investigated in breast is de-escalation of therapy based on the risk, based on the detection of cell-free DNA as an MRD. Most of the studies in breast cancer trying to compare an intervention versus another, but I think it's almost unethical to have a control group when you have a positive cell-free DNA. So we have to get a little bit more pragmatic in that sense. And certainly de-escalation can be a very good goal. In breast cancer, we are giving now CDK4/6 to patients with stage 2 disease, and in patients with stage 3, of course, high risk. Maybe the idea of de-escalation, instead of giving a drug for 2 or 3 years to everyone, will be very appealing to patients especially. And I think this, as a community of breast oncologists interested in translational research, we should do that.
We had a great discussion about circulating tumor cells. On circulating tumor DNA, I just wanted to explain one concept because this is going to come up as well. There are different ways to look for mutations in the blood sample that's collected. One way is called a panel. They look for the most common mutations for that disease, for example. In colon cancer, KRAS mutations are very common, and so you might devise a strategy where you can look for the most common mutations that occur in the cancer, and then if you identify them in the DNA that's from the blood, you can say with some high fidelity that that represents circulating tumor DNA. So this is what we call a tumor-uninformed analysis. The other way to do it is actually a tumor-informed analysis. So you take the patient's tumor, you sequence it, you identify specific areas that you want to track in the blood, and then using the patient's individual tumor, you can then track those mutations in the blood. And that's very specific for recurrence of that patient's cancer or identification of that patient's cancer in other areas. And so that might be important as we move forward. But what we're really highlighting is the technology around liquid biopsy. You mentioned all the different technology on circulating tumor cells and the applications of not only looking at the DNA, but also looking at the expression and the receptors and things like that is one aspect. And then there's technology on circulating tumor DNA, which is on how to assess for those mutations. And I'd like for you to maybe expand a little bit on marrying these two. They're two different things, and we've talked in the past that they should be used synergistically. It's not one or the other, but we should use both.
That's correct. I mean, just an example, we had a study where we collected and analyzed circulating tumor cells and circulating tumor cell estrogen expression in the context of a prospective randomized study. We did three different arms for patients that progress on a CDK4/6 versus the combination now of Fastrax Palbo in that case, and Avelumab combination with Palbo and Fulvestrant in the third arm. So the three groups, they were essentially complementary and equal in terms of efficacy if you don't stratify. And when you look at the stratification, and we had also cell-free DNA, the two factors that really differentiated was the fact that you have CTCs, and so the patient with fulvestrant did worse, and you had a ESR mutation, single agent fulvestrant did worse. And then you start to find out that, in fact, circulating tumor cells in patients with fulvestrant had also less estrogen receptor expression and were associated with ESR mutation. So the complementary aspect of this is very important. I want to go back to an aspect that you were analyzing, is the issue of technology development. Now, the DNA, we've been talking so far about the mutation, single variants and amplification fusions. We can detect all of that. But now there is another aspect that is the methylation of DNA. For some of the technology, particular with the ability to detect small fraction of methylated DNA, are now moving into the area of screening. You know about colorectal cancer screening and multi-omic screening. With some of this technology in the future, we'll be able to predict which organ we have the methylation signal coming from and direct our imaging. So I think it's fascinating that now the blood has the ability to provide all the information that we need, and probably not far the day where we will go from early disease detection associated with the modality we use right now according to guidelines, all the way to the disease progression, treatment, primary treatment, monitor after primary treatment, and metastatic disease evolution. So I think this is an area where our students, our fellows, and our trainee will be find themselves really in an area of practice that completely different from what we were training for. And that's important that we train this junior faculty and trainee to the use and understanding of this technology to be able to apply them in the clinic in the near future.
I think it's a really important thing that you highlight. And I think this is true almost exponentially over the last 20 years in oncology, that our ability to advance technology is almost exponential. So the circulating tumor DNA story has been around for about 10 years, and the methylation part of it is, I think, maybe 5 years. So it's just accelerating, and it's quite amazing. And you're absolutely right. It's probably not you or I, but other people that we're training, or even others that will advance the field even further. This is a perfect segue to what are you most excited about moving to the future? You know, it feels a little bit like Star Trek, where you have some kind of a device, you could just look at something and make a diagnosis. I know we're not there and it's kind of fantasy land, but we're making progress, aren't we?
The ability to detect very early on cancer can overcome many difficulties in terms of compliance, access to screening. We know that there's never going to be 100% participation in mammography screening, colorectal screening. We see tumors in much younger individuals right now, and I think we will need to figure out how to implement this blood screening even in individuals that have not an obvious risk besides the genetic risk. The genetic risk, to me, seems to be the first area of intervention. When you look at the statistics, at the global level, the majority of these patients and mortality come from countries that have low resources. So we need to make this test easier to implement, much less expensive. We can certainly change the survival primarily by screening and early disease detection and not from implementing double or triplet with very expensive drugs. So I think this is where I see the field is going, where I would like to contribute to. And hopefully this would be a dream that comes true in the near future.
Well, that's terrific. I think if we can use the technology to the benefit of where care is not easy to be received, it could have the biggest impact. Dr. Cristinelli, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me and for bringing up this important topic.
Well, that's all for now, folks. You can download, subscribe, rate, and review CancerCast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or online at wildcornell.org. We also encourage you to write to us at cancercast@med.cornell.edu with questions, comments, and topics you'd like to hear us cover in the future. That's it for CancerCast, conversations about new developments in medicine, cancer care, and research. I'm Dr. Manish Shah. Thanks for listening.
All information contained in this podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes. The information is not intended nor suited to be a replacement or substitute for professional medical treatment or for professional medical advice relative to a specific medical question or condition. We urge you to always seek the advice of your physician or medical professional with respect to your medical condition or questions. While Cornell Medicine makes no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast, and any reliance on such information is done at your own risk. Participants may have consulting, equity, board membership, or other relationships with pharmaceutical, biotech, or device companies unrelated to their role in this podcast. No payments have been made by any company to endorse any treatments, devices, or procedures, and while Cornell Medicine does not endorse, approve, or recommend any product, service, or entity mentioned in this podcast. Opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker and do not represent the perspectives of Weill Cornell Medicine as an institution.